The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, or coming to you live here at Edstone. A chilly day at Edstone, about 40 degrees. For some reason, though, 40 degrees in the UK always seems a little bit cooler than 40 degrees in Oklahoma. I don't quite know why, but in any event, it's cold and it's quiet here around Edstone. Quite a few people are off and about over this Thanksgiving break, the U.S. holiday. We're coming up to that tomorrow, and on today's show, we'll actually have a Thanksgiving reminder from President Ronald Reagan. He's always a good one to turn to for some quality sound bites, and we'll be playing a bit from a statement he made in 1985 regarding something to remember on Thanksgiving. And speaking of Thanksgiving, the American tradition, at least for presidents, is to pardon a turkey every year just before Thanksgiving. President Trump did that yesterday and showed that he does have somewhat of a sense of humor. So you'll have to wait around for those sound bites. We'll play them at the end of the program today. So stay with us all the way through to the end. Well, some of you might remember an article that we printed 10 years ago at The Trumpet. It was in The Trumpet magazine as well. And we asked the question, can Joe Biden save the world? And if you remember that article, it referred to a CNN interview. This was during the Democratic presidential primaries. He was running at that time against Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And during the CNN interview, Joe Biden said, my party has the chance to nominate someone to save the world. Literally, save the world. This is a direct quote. You have a chance. You people voting, you have a chance to save the world. He said the direction this world is going in is an absolute disaster. I mean, this was following President Bush. President Bush, just a total disaster, he said. He said 4 more years of this may be irreversible. Well, this CNN reporter asked him, point blank, can Joe Biden save the world? Yes. Yes, I can, he said. No hesitation. Not even a second. Not even a split second of hesitation. Joe Biden was prepared to save the world. There's plenty of that kind of thinking around in politics today. It's still there. I think you could even say it's somewhat worse. Hard to believe that was 10 years ago. Well, Barack Obama won that primary, and then Joe Biden was selected as his vice president. And they certainly didn't solve the problems of this world during that 8-year administration. They certainly didn't save the world. The Telegraph, Richard gave this to me this morning, just the ongoing fighting and struggling over Brexit here in the UK. And again, the thinking that you see in some of these politicians, just the arrogance that they know the way to fix this particular problem or the way to work through this predicament. This is, again, the Telegraph saying that it's beginning to look like a Brexit conspiracy. It says here, those of us who voted for Brexit on the day, on that day, speaking of June, I think 23rd, 2016, it's just 2.5 years, not even, a little over 2 years ago. Those of us who voted for Brexit on that day did not want a deal. We wanted to leave the European Union, and to return to a situation where Parliament made the laws for our own people. We wanted out, in other words. Those of us that voted for this, We voted for Brexit because we wanted an exit, just like the name implies. We wanted to leave. We wanted to come out. He says here, pretty clear, you might think, since then, what we all thought of as Brexit has been tactically renamed No Deal by the BBC and prominent Remainers in order to make it sound scary and disastrous, when in fact, it restores the perfectly normal state of affairs, which applies in almost every other country on Earth. They're working overtime here, the news media, BBC, the prominent Remainers, to scare Britain, to scare the British people, to make them think that exiting the EU without a deal, quote-unquote, it would be disastrous. The UK wouldn't survive it. And as this op-ed piece brings out, there's literally hundreds of nations in the world who are not a part of this deal, this union. We want our sovereignty back. We want our own parliament to make laws for our own people. But you see what's happened in 2 years' time. Here the radical left has reframed the entire debate. And now, like this article brings out, now we're supposed to believe that Brexit is renamed No Deal. And No Deal is bad. We have to have a deal. We have to have some kind of a deal. Even if it's a bad deal. Any deal. A bad deal is better than no deal. It says here, signs of the conspiracy against Brexit are everywhere, rather. They're there in the relentless briefings against anyone who dares to openly challenge Theresa May's dreadful deal. It's a dreadful deal. We've noted that over the last week. But anyone who stands up to challenge it, they're immediately demonized. They're immediately made out to be the villain. Dominic Raab, he's one of the ones that resigned, I think, last Friday. He went from principled, highly respected Brexit secretary to ambitious traitor. He resigned, and so, well, now he's a traitor. Raab's name has to be blackened, lest the plebs, that's you and me, start believing the things he says about Brussels bullying UK negotiators and share his shock and dismay when he discovered civil servants had sneaked clauses into the withdrawal agreement overnight without telling him. So there was all this nefarious activity going on. The EU was bullying its way through these negotiations. And Mr. Raab speaks up and says, this is what happened. This is how it went down. And as this article brings out, he's the one that's demonized. It says, what right had those unelected officials to deceive and undermine a government minister? It's not Jacob Rees-Mogg who's guilty of staging a coup. The coup has been staged by civil service against the British people. That's where the real coup is here. But the ones who are standing up to sound the alarm, they're the ones who are demonized. And it works the same way in the United States in many cases. The Telegraph says Brexit was supposed to mean people taking back power from a faceless, controlling elite, which was happy to see Britain subsumed into a European superstate. And now the faceless, controlling elite, through its overwhelming influence in the media, its multi-million pound stratagems, is exerting that power to kill Brexit. So we've noted this statement in my father's article earlier this year so many times, mostly with respect to what was happening in the United States in the lead up to the presidential election in 2016. But there's some parallels here with respect to this Brexit deal, which also was voted on in 2016. My father says in that article, the radical left article, we're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power and to stay in power. They have no respect for the rule of law. They believe they are above the law. They know better. In this case, they know better than the people. The majority voted to exit, to leave. They didn't go into the voting booth and think, well, I'm voting for Brexit because I really, really, really want to do this dreadful deal with the EU. They just voted to leave. And the elites in government, they won't accept it. They're trying to get around it. They're doing anything that they can to get around it. Because in their heart of hearts, they wanted to remain all along anyway. This is something that Jacob Rees-Mogg pointed out last week. Notice further, this is the conclusion of that Telegraph piece. The Prime Minister is an electoral liability. She would do her party and country a great service if she accepted just how unpopular she is and stood aside for a better leader. No chance of that. As the endgame and the conspiracy against Brexit begins, there's a conspiracy here. They're working to kill Brexit. It says, according to one source, Downing Street officials have discussed an even darker strategy to twist arms. Number 10's plan is to encourage a crash in financial markets after losing a first vote in the hope that this stampedes MPs into voting for it a second time. That's according to a source in Mrs. May's government, one of her advisors. And then the column here concludes with this. It should beggar belief that our own Prime Minister's aides are discussing tanking the economy so they can get her wretched deal through. These days, it barely raises an eyebrow. That's just politics as usual. Here they're discussing tanking the economy in order to get what they want done, in order to get this dreadful deal through. He says, we live in strange times when they call patriots traitors and politicians acting on the people's behalf are rebels. It's just like we've been discussing, even recently, that passage in Isaiah 5, calling evil good and good evil. It's upside down. He says, there's going to be a heavy price to be paid for the conspiracy against Brexit. You just look, though, at the leadership, that spirit reflected in those statements from Joe Biden in 2008, the arrogance, the pomposity. There are no bounds. These are elites who will do anything to maintain their grip on power, to carry out their will, to impose their will. My father writes about will worship in his booklet on Colossians, quoting Colossians 2 and verse 23. It says in the Revised Standard Version, these have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting rigor of devotion and self-abasement and severity to the body, but they are of no value in checking the indulgence of the flesh. It has a show of wisdom, it says in the King James. It seems humble. It sounds humble. It sounds righteous. But what it boils down to is will worship. Will worship. You look into the King James there, or a better translation, as my father has brought out, means forced worship of angels or demons, fallen angels, that is. And we've seen in this last era of God's church, so many of God's people that have been deceived by philosophy, vain deceit, human reasoning. We saw what it did to the Church of God. We saw what it did to the United States during the Antiochus administration. Barack Obama, by the way, he gave an interview where he talked about climate change, and all the things that he could do right now if he was still in power, what he could change given the technology that we have available to us. Here's what he said yesterday, clip one.
It's climate change. We're going to come up with some new technologies to solve the problem as much as we need to. Although even on something like that, right now I could take off the shelf existing technologies. We could reduce carbon emissions by, let's say, 30%.
Now, this was a man who, I believe before the presidency, he was in Congress in Washington, I mean, for at least 2 years. Before that, he was in government in Illinois. But following that presidential run where he was competing with Joe Biden in 2008, he became president. He had a majority of Democrats in Congress for the first 2 years. He was president for 8 years. He could take something, I guess, off the shelf and reduce carbon emissions by 30%. And I guess I wonder, why didn't he do it? Why didn't he do it when he was in power? What major legislation? All right, it was a Republican majority that he had to fight against. Maybe that's why, people would say. But the first 2 years, there was nothing in terms of climate change legislation. Nothing. And now he comes along. Of course, you understand what the big problem is in the minds of these radicals. It's Donald Trump. It's pulling out of the Paris Accords. And so there he sits saying that I could take existing technology that's on the shelf right now, this very moment, and reduce carbon emissions by 30%. You know, the president, President Trump, I mean, recently, he's gotten all of this flack for saying that we should be doing more to rake away the scrubs and the brush and the dead wood and such in these California forests so that there's not so much fuel for these fires that have just been so devastating. Of course, he's being ridiculed for this. And all that they say is that it's climate change, and he's to blame because he pulled out of the Paris Accords. This article in The Spectator says President Trump's critics are belittling him for not buying the politically correct narrative that global warming is to blame for the California fires. Instead, Mr. Trump correctly points to decades of mistakes by state and federal forest agencies that caused the woodlands to become overly dense and blanketed with highly flammable dead wood and underbrush. So this fire, it's engulfed 230 square miles. 80 people by now have been killed. There's still hundreds missing. And it says here, Californians were warned of this impending inferno. Earlier this year, a bipartisan state panel, the Little Hoover Commission, reported that for over a century, state and federal forest managers have mistakenly put out small fires instead of allowing them to burn naturally to rid woodlands of dense underbrush and deadwood. The Little Hoover panel condemned this century of fire suppression. Why aren't you raking the forest, in other words? And it goes and gives some other warnings that have been given over the past many years. It says in 2006, the Western Governors Association cautioned about another contributing factor, failure to thin the forests. After the spotted owl was added to the list of threatened species in 1990, President Bill Clinton imposed limits on timber harvesting, which fell by 80%, and halted new road building in federal forests. Too bad, roads serve as a natural fire barrier and also enable firefighters to get to the blazes. So they wanted to save the spotted owl in the 1990s. And so Bill Clinton passed this legislation limiting timber harvesting, limiting road construction in these forest areas. It says, add to these mistakes the drought that gripped California in 2012, then again in 2017, and on it goes. It says, even California's own legislature recognizes that forest mismanagement is the tragedy's major cause. The legislature passed a law 2 months ago to implement many of the same changes Mr. Trump's now being mocked for proposing: controlled burning, underbrush removal, and forest thinning. That's what the president has suggested. He's been mocked. He's been ridiculed. Here are things. Here are some steps we can take to try to prevent another out-of-control wildfire. And he says it, and he's mocked relentlessly. President Obama gets up, says that, hey, I could pull technology off the shelf and reduce carbon emissions by 30%. Of course, he's applauded. But then he went on to explain in this same interview why he's been unable, or why they have been unable, to have the breakthrough that they've needed to actually reduce carbon emissions. Here's what he went on to say in the same interview, clip two.
The reason we don't do it is because we are still confused, blind, shrouded with hate, anger, racism, mommy issues.
That's President Obama explaining why they can't fix these problems because of the other side. It's all politics. There he is with the politics of division, the same old from the radical left. The problem is the other side. The problem is hate, anger, racism. He went on to say that we're fraught with this stuff. It's all over the place. The problem is Donald Trump. But I'm the solution. I could take it off the shelf right this moment and fix everything. Or at least reduce it by 30%. And we're on the road. He made another astounding remark about just his life in politics. This is basically Barack Obama explaining how much smarter he is than everyone else he's ever worked with in politics. Here's clip three.
Here's the interesting thing that happens when you're president, or when you go through the experience of being president. So you start off, you know, you're a community organizer and you're struggling to try to get people to recognize each other's common interests. And, you know, you're trying to get some project done in a small community. And you start thinking, okay, you know what, this alderman's a knucklehead and, you know, they're resistant to doing the right thing. And so I need to get more knowledge, more power, more influence so that I can really have an impact. And so you go to the state legislature and you look around and you say, well, these jamokes, I mean, not all of them, but I'm just saying, you know, you start getting that sense of, this is just like dealing with the alderman, right? So, no, I got to do something different. So then you go to the U.S. Senate and you're looking around and you're like, oh, man. And then when you're president, you're sitting in these international meetings, and it's like the G20, and you got all these world leaders, and it's the same people.
The same people all the way through. They're all dumb. They're all in the way. They're all living with hatred and anger, racism, mommy issues, whatever. But he knows, Joe Biden knows, the elites here in the UK, they know how to fix everything. Even if it goes against the majority, they still know. They have all the answers. Can you solve the problems of this world? Yes, I can, so many of them say. We glorify that sort of thing. At least many people do. Those that are there clapping and cheering, you heard them. George Washington, when he came into his role, his office as president in 1789, he said that he lacked that competency of political skill, abilities, and inclination which is necessary to manage the helm. That's an eloquent way of saying, I'm not capable of doing this. I don't have what it takes. Which is why he said, God had better help me. God better help me with this. Abraham Lincoln said similar statements. You go back to the Old Testament, you look at King Solomon coming into his position as king. He told God, I don't know how to go in or come out. And yet you've chosen me to lead such a great people. You're going to have to give me wisdom and understanding. You're going to have to show me how to do this. Jesus would have said something very similar to that. He, in the New Testament, said, I can of my own self do nothing. You don't hear many statements like that today coming from politicians. They know. And even when they have a long track record, 8 years in the White House, where nothing to speak of was done, except for signing a piece of paper, that's all, but nothing was done to reduce carbon emissions. If this is the religion, if this is what they believe in, if this is the altar that they worship at, what did they do? If it's so easy, just grab it off the shelf, get it moving, and 30% reduction, just like that, the snap of a finger. In fact, they don't know. They don't know, and their record shows it. And God's trying to help us to see that we can't make this work, that we can't fix these problems. The one who's been right all along, and we've mentioned that quote over and again from Mr. Armstrong in 1973 with respect to Brexit, with respect to joining the European Union. Well, there's some ominous potentialities here. This is not good. This is not going to work out well for the UK. He was right. Only God can solve our mounting problems. The prophet Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 16, says, wash you, make you clean, put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil and learn to do well, the prophet said. Seek judgment. Seek judgment. He says in verse 18, come now and let us reason together, says the Eternal. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. That's what true education amounts to. It's reasoning with God. It's going to God like Solomon did and saying, God, I don't know the way to go here. You're going to have to show me. God's trying to help us to stop following and trusting in man. He wants us to come and reason together with him, and he'll show us. He'll give us the answers. He'll show us the way. He'll lead us. Just like it says about the Holy Spirit in Romans 8. As many as are led by God's Spirit. When we come back, we'll get into the subject of liberty and go to a statement that President Ronald Reagan made back in 1985 with respect to Thanksgiving. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
You know, the Statue of Liberty and this wonderful holiday called Thanksgiving go together naturally because, although as Americans we have many things for which to be thankful, none is more important than our liberty. Liberty, that quality of government, that brightness of mind and spirit for which the Pilgrim Fathers braved the seas and Americans through two centuries have laid down their lives. Today, while religion is suppressed in perhaps one-third of the world, we Americans are free to worship the Almighty as we choose. While entire nations must endure the yoke of tyranny, we are free to speak our minds, to enjoy an unfettered and vigorous press, and to make government abide by the limits we deem just. While millions live behind walls, we remain free to travel throughout the land, to share this precious day with those we love most deeply, the members of our families. My fellow Americans, let us keep this Thanksgiving Day sacred. Let us thank God for the bounty and goodness of our nation. And as a measure of our gratitude, let us rededicate ourselves to the preservation of this, the land of the free and the home of the brave.
The land of the free. There's President Reagan from 1985 saying, of all the things that we have to be thankful for, we ought to be thankful most for our liberty, for the freedom that we have in the United States of America to worship, the freedom that we have to travel to and fro all across the world. And lots of people don't have this liberty. So many people in this world are trapped in captivity of some kind or another. We hold these truths to be self-evident, it says at the preamble of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you move to the end of that document, the Declaration of Independence, the signers, 56 of them, they mutually pledged. They pledged to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And by signing that document, they were, in the eyes of the British, they were committing treason. And so many of them had to pay a heavy price. As Paul Harvey brought out in his classic monologue from many years ago, I've played this before, mostly, I think, once or twice around the Independence Day holiday. But here's what Paul Harvey said in that classic monologue about those 57 or 56 signers, clip 7.
Of the 56, few were long to survive. 5 were captured by the British and tortured before they died. 12 had their homes from Rhode Island to Charleston sacked, looted, occupied by the enemy, or burned. 2 lost their sons in the army. 1 had 2 sons captured. 9 of the 56 died in the war from its hardships or from its more merciful bullets. I don't know what impression you had of the men who met that summer in Philadelphia. But I think it's important that we remember this about them. They were not poor men. They were not wild-eyed pirates. These were men of means. They were rich men, most of them, and had enjoyed much ease and luxury in their personal living. Not hungry men, certainly not terrorists, not irresponsible malcontents, not fanatical incendiaries. These men were prosperous men, wealthy landowners. They were substantially secure in their prosperity. They had everything to lose. But they considered liberty, and this is as much as I shall say of it, they had learned that liberty is so much more important than security, that they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And they fulfilled their pledge. They paid the price. And freedom was born.
Paul Harvey talking about the sacrifices that the founders made, those who signed the Declaration of Independence, that price paid, a heavy price paid for the freedoms that so many of us now take for granted. There was a Federalist piece a few weeks ago. I've been meaning to get to it, but it seemed like it fit with today's segment, this segment in particular. But it says, in an America this ignorant, it's no wonder we struggle to stay free. We're losing so many of these freedoms. Or we're deceived into thinking the government, this massive, bloated, oversized government, is what gives us freedom. It says here, Americans are suffering from a knowledge gap about what American freedom is about. And it's one of the most important underlying factors of what divides Americans today. So many in America are divided over this subject of liberty. What is it? How did we get it? Why do we enjoy so many freedoms? It says, once upon a time, American students got an unvarnished look at the U.S. Constitution. They learned about the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as stated in the Declaration of Independence. Equality of opportunity, minimal interference from the government, checks and balances, the separations of powers. It says the logic of barring the state from policing our speech and our thoughts and our conscience was simple to comprehend. People can only be free if they are free from government restraints. Bloat government power, and pretty soon the state owns you, body and soul. It mentions that it used to be that students would come through school, high school and college, and have a pretty good grasp of the Constitution and its context, the Declaration of Independence. They used to be taught these things in school, but not any longer. It's not even that they're not taught these things. It's that they're taught that these things are evil or racist or unfair, unjust. These founding documents, these founding fathers. It says this knowledge and clarity about our founding principles has become deeply eroded. Many Americans have been taught to believe America is the root of evil in the world. Many are struck in their own grievance and victim mentality. And as weirdly twisted as this gets, they think government force is both the source and guarantor of their freedom. Government force. It says decades of a steady diet of distortions, dishonesty, and government largesse coming from so many of the American elites, academia, media, and political leaders who don't believe in the merits of the very system that allowed them to flourish. Just like in the first segment, just like Barack Obama. Here he's benefiting from this system to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, something like $100 million now. He's been made famous. He and the elites, in the media, in government. And here are people who don't believe in the very system that allowed them to flourish. It says, indeed, a century ago, radicals were espousing a long march through the institutions explicitly to undermine Western civilization. Academia has been saturated with arrogant, anti-thought professors who enforce non-thinking on students. The media has been flooded with elitist, anti-thought pundits who enforce non-thinking on the general public. and Hollywood is saturated with self-important celebrities who spread their special brands of mindlessness among their millions of adoring fans. How can we, if we're this ignorant, how can we hold on to liberty? How can we maintain these freedoms that we're able to enjoy? Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. It's not possible. If you expect to be ignorant and free, that's not going to happen, said Thomas Jefferson. John Adams also believed that education was the key to maintaining liberty. We've been reading through some of that history in David McCullough's biography on John Adams. And Adams was a firm believer that the government should encourage and develop an educated populace. We haven't done that, though. McCullough said it was, in all, a declaration of Adams' faith in education as the bulwark of a good society. The old abiding faith of his Puritan forebears, the survival of rights and liberties of the people, depended on the spread of wisdom, knowledge, and virtue among all people. It depended on the spread of wisdom, the survival of rights and liberties, he said. He believed. If you look at some of the things he wrote in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Constitution, for example, and of course he had an influence on the U.S. Constitution as well, even though he was in London at the time. But these men were grounded in so many of these principles that you see in the Declaration, that you see in the U.S. Constitution. And this is what so many of our young people have gotten away from, so many young and old people. Our own history. You know, it's interesting, this Federalist piece, it points back to the example of Josiah. I'll just read a few verses from 2 Chronicles 34. It points to Josiah, this history, and the reawakening that happened in Judah when they got back to their founding document, the Pentateuch. It says in the Federalist, if you actually read the Bible, you can easily conclude that the history of the Jews is in many ways a reflection of the history of all humanity, wandering, enslaved, aware of a higher law, triumphant, then losing reverence for their laws, losing their identity, only to end up drifting and held captive once again. They get out, they get away from God, and then they go into captivity. And it takes something like that to happen to wake them up, to remind them of what they had, to remind them of how special their history was and is. Josiah came along. He was 8 years old, an 8-year-old king, an 8-year-old who was converted to the truth of God, whose mind was open to the truth. When he was 16, he had a relationship with God as a teenager. And then when he turned 20 years of age, he started to purge Judah and Jerusalem of all of this rampant idolatry. This is a unique 20-year-old. It says, now in the 18th year of his reign, so this would have been, he's 26 at this point. When he was 26, when he had purged the land and the house, he sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, and Maaseiah, the governor of the city, and Joah, the son of Joahaz, the recorder, to repair the house of the Eternal as God. So he's ridding the nation of idolatry. And then at 26, he says, all right, now let's focus on the temple. Let's remodel the temple. Down in verse 14, this is 2 Chronicles 34, it says, and when they brought out the money that was brought into the house of the Eternal, Hilkiah the priest found a book of the law of the Eternal given by Moses. So here's Hilkiah working in the temple, and he finds this book of the law, probably either the first five books of the Bible or Deuteronomy, and whatever it was, he was overwhelmed as he started to scroll through the content. And Shaphan, he reacted the same way. Clark's commentary says about the parallel verse, you can find that passage in 2 Kings 22. It says about that statement, I have found the book of the law. Clark says, was this the autograph of Moses? Perhaps a scroll autographed, signed by Moses himself. Just like those signers of the Declaration of Independence. 56 of them, the sacrifices made for that founding document. And these individuals probably had some working understanding of those Bible passages. But getting the original document, seeing it, seeing Moses' signature, if that's what it was, it moved these individuals. It moved Hilkiah. It moved Shaphan. And it moved the king as well. Verse 18 says, and Shaphan, the scribe, told the king, saying, Hilkiah, the priest, has given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And it came to pass, when the king had heard the words of the law, then he rent his clothes. He just started ripping his clothes. This is after he had pulverized all of these pagan idols and then renovated the house of God. And then he reads from Deuteronomy. He reads from the Pentateuch. And it had a powerful impact on these leading men, these leaders. They were humbled by this truth. They didn't react with arrogance and pomposity and say, well, forget this document. I know the way to go here. We don't need that old document. We just need, look, we've got the tools right here ourselves. We can fix all these problems. No problem. The Federalist says here about this example, King Josiah of Judah ruled over the 7th century kingdom that had forgotten its laws and worshipped pagan idols. Its Jewish identity was so lost that they were unaware of the Passover. And then one day, a priest stumbled upon the long-lost Book of the Law while going through the temple. He announced his discovery to King Josiah, who was deeply moved by the rediscovery of the law and his people's true heritage. He led a great awakening. They got back into the book. They got back into their founding document. And it triggered a great awakening in Judah. And you can read more about it in this same chapter, 2 Chronicles 34. He went to the school of, I forget the name of the prophetess in the next few verses. They immersed themselves into this. There was a college there in Jerusalem, and they started to study. They turned the scholars loose. Look, we've got to get into this document. We've got to understand this document that Moses signed. Look down at verse 29, it says, then the king sent and gathered together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. And the king went up into the house of the Eternal, and all the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and the Levites and all the people, great and small. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant that was found in the house of the Eternal. Josiah brought all of them to the temple. Even the common people, the leadership all the way down to the plebs, so to speak. And he read God's law to them. He went back to Mount Sinai. He went back to the covenant that God made with the nation of Israel. Verse 31 says, "And the king stood in his place and made a covenant before the Eternal to walk after the Eternal and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of the covenant which are written in this book." And he caused all that were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin to stand to it. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem did according to the covenant of God, the God of their fathers. So he led the people, Josiah did, to renew that covenant that God had made with Israel. He led them to a faithful and sincere obedience of the Sabbath and holy day commands. It says in verse 33, "And Josiah took away all the abominations out of the countries that pertained to the children of Israel, and made all that were present in Israel to serve, even to serve the Lord their God. And all his days they departed not from following the Eternal, the God of their fathers." He immersed himself into this founding document, reading and studying something that was 600, 700 years old? That's an old book. That's an old document. He got into it. The priests got into it. The Levites. All of those who officiated at the temple, the various temple responsibilities and duties, and then all the common people too. And this is what triggered a great awakening in Judah. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a couple of sound bites from yesterday. President Trump pardoning a couple of turkeys before Thanksgiving. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. This is KPCG-FM. And this is the Trumpet Daily.
Well, after going back to President Reagan in 1985 and then even back into the Old Testament to the days of Solomon and Josiah and Moses, you kind of want to stay there and not come back to 2018, but we'll do it anyway. This was from yesterday, President Trump. Nothing profound here, but it was funny to listen to it last night. This is him doing the Thanksgiving tradition of pardoning a turkey. I guess this time he decided to pardon two turkeys, and you can listen to him explain. This is clip 5.
In this grand tradition, I am pleased to announce that today's lucky bird and guest of honor is named Pease, along with his alternate named Carrots. The children will understand that. The winner of this vote was decided by a fair and open election conducted on the White House website. This was a fair election. Unfortunately, Carrots refused to concede and demanded a recount, and we're still fighting with Carrots. And I will tell you, we've come to a conclusion. Carrots, I'm sorry to tell you, the result did not change. It's too bad for Carrots.
That's President Trump there yesterday poking fun at all of this nonsense in Florida, counting and then recounting and then fighting over it in court, as we've covered recently. And then he went on to say something else that was also pretty funny. This is clip 6.
After their good fortune today, Peas and Carrots will both live out the rest of their days at Gobbler's Rest on the campus of Virginia Tech. Good place, where they will enjoy a beautiful private enclosure under the care of poultry science students and veterinarians. In other words, they're going to be well taken care of it Virginia Tech. However, it won't be entirely arrest. Even though peas and carrots have received a presidential pardon, I have warned them that House Democrats are likely to issue them both subpoenas.
So there you go. The turkeys have been pardoned, but they may not be out of the woods yet if the House Democrats have their way and go after them with subpoenas and investigations and spying and just about everything else that you can imagine. That's President Trump poking fun at the never-ending investigations that have been going on before even he became president. It continues even to this day. Well, coming up on tomorrow's broadcast, you'll be hearing from Brad McDonald right here from Ed Stone. And then on Friday, you have Andrew Locher. He's going to be speaking live from our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. So you've got new programming coming up even on this holiday weekend in the United States. And then I'll be back with you on Monday. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow. I'll see you next week.